But we can do better than to grieve and despair. We can do better than to simply hide from God, the way Adam did after his sin, or than to ask God to leave us, the way Peter did after the miraculous draught of fish. We can present ourselves to the Lord in our naked truth, and show him our wounds. Sin that is discerned, avowed, and repudiated, is no longer sin but only misery, and calls down God's most gentle mercy upon us. Because we acknowledge our sin, call it by its right name, dissociate ourselves from it, and expose it to God's purifying gaze, suddenly it is no longer pernicious, and we are miraculously purified. The man who, during prayer and through the day, lives in this attitude of confessing his sin to God, is a limpid pool in which the purity of heaven is reflected. During our conversation, I let the following exclamation slip out: "Ah! I really know this old self of mine, swarming with sin." The reply came so quickly that I thought for an instant that my friend was delivered from his paralysis. Do not calumniate the depths of your being. In a child of God, it is not the innermost being that is contaminated by sin, but only certain obscure regions that have not yet been evangelized. Never forget that the innermost being of a Christian, after his baptism, is luminous, radiant, and infinitely pure, thanks to the presence within it of the Blessed Trinity. If Christians only understood that heaven is not somewhere else, but right there within them, in the heart of their heart. Their innermost self is already completely immersed in the infinite love of God. If they realized it, they would need to do only one thing: allow this love to destroy the last pockets of resistance, and conquer all the cantons of their interior world. Are you going to say that I am not really answering your request for advice on the way to proceed with your mental prayer? But this attitude of avowing our sin is the warp and woof of all true prayer, as indeed it is of the Christian life. 24. To someone who believes he is unworthy of praying. I was questioning a widow on the development of her spiritual life, so as to counsel her in a more knowledgeable way. She told me, "I owe my interior life to Sergius, her husband. More precisely, to his attitude toward me during a shameful phase of my conjugal life. Married for 5 years and the mother of 2 children, I was being unfaithful to him. But I still loved him. Not wanting to destroy his happiness, I made sure that he had no reason to suspect me. His love for me, of exceptional quality, deepens day after day. One evening, I remember it as if it were yesterday, he expressed his tenderness, his esteem, and his admiration for me in terms that touched my heart. It was too much. The words escaped me, 'If you only knew.' He answered, 'I do know.' These words triggered violent indignation on my part, unjustified as it was. 'Well then, why are you playing this shocking game with me? Either you are not hurt by what you know, and that is proof that you do not love me, or else you are greatly disturbed and your serenity is only a lie.' I was beside myself, aggressive, scoffing, insulting. He waited until the storm was over. Then he replied calmly, gravely, tenderly, 'Please understand. For 6 months I have been suffering cruelly. My own suffering was bearable, because it didn't degrade me. But your evil did degrade you, and this was intolerable for my love. I saw clearly what I had to do, the only thing I could do. I had to love you still more than before, so that you might be resurrected to love, that this brand new love might not only burn away your evil in its flames, but create a new heart for you, a new purity, a more radiant beauty than ever. And in fact, Sergius' love made me into this new being right then and there.' This woman's disclosure enabled me to grasp more clearly what true forgiveness is. When forgiveness is condescending, it begets revolt. When it is reticent, it is burdensome. Forgiveness without love can neither deliver nor save. Only true forgiveness, the fruit of a very pure love, can call forth a living wellspring in the heart of the unfaithful one. Only that can regenerate the one who betrayed love, by enabling him or her to be reborn to love. Can I hope that recounting this distant memory will help you to understand what God is expecting of you? You wrote, "I feel I am unworthy of praying." Well then, when will you pray? When you have succeeded in extricating yourself from sin, in stripping yourself of every stain and imperfection. Are you going to forget that only the love of Christ can purify you, transform you, and sanctify you? Instead of fleeing from Christ, why don't you pray mentally and expose your sinner's soul to His gaze? You will discover that for God, to forgive is to love. It is so intense that a brand new love springs up within the darkness and impurity of the soul, a love that not only purifies and regenerates it, but makes it accede to a totally new perfection. Think of the look that Christ gave Peter, who had just denied him. Do you believe that it was a look of reproach or anger? Far more terrible, it was a look of more intense love, expressing a more solicitous, burning, and encompassing tenderness than ever. Peter could not resist it. His heart was broken, pouring itself out in tears that were at once bitter and sweet. At the same time, under the conjoined action of Christ's gaze and of His Spirit at work in Peter, a new love took possession of his whole being. As a result, just a few days after his denial, he dared to affirm to Christ without hesitation, "You know well that I love you," John 21:17. He could have added, "I have loved you in very truth since the other night." Peter was not lying. This new love, that his master's gaze had caused to well up in him, would impel him onward until he gave his own life on a cross, after a life consumed in preaching to the multitudes about the way that God loves us. 25. From head to foot. A number of things make you unhappy and anxious. Your meditations as arid as a desert, your lack of spiritual vitality at the hour of prayer, the feeling that the Lord no longer opens the door at which you are constantly knocking. You tell me that you are eager to rediscover, if not fervor, at least those periods of mental prayer in which you were sure that you were not wasting your time. I certainly have no infallible advice to give you. I would simply invite you to find out for yourself what God is expecting of you. It is possible that this is a trial permitted by the Lord to whet your desire, and stimulate your search and your trust. But it may also be a signal, a warning that something is lacking in your life. I ask you not to eliminate the latter hypothesis too quickly. You write, "Never before have I striven so scrupulously to follow your advice on the practice of mental prayer." I am the first to agree. That is precisely what makes me think that there is something in need of change, not so much in your manner of praying as in your life. In the Christian life, everything is interrelated. If the practice of one virtue is neglected, if the sacraments are not received often enough, and if the will of God is disregarded on some point, the effects are felt everywhere, and first of all in the life of prayer. That is why I'm not sure that your intense effort to pray better is the best course for you. Begin by trying to discover whether God is expecting some reform on your part. Examine yourself first on the theological life, the foundation of the Christian life. And in the very first place, examine yourself on charity. Perhaps you are not gracious to your neighbor, eager to serve him, to witness to the love of God, who has given you an insight into and a taste for His infinite goodness. That would explain why the Lord, I will not say rejects you, but withdraws from you the sense of His presence and of His love. Love those around you. Make an effort to reach out to those with whom you are less spontaneously sympathetic. Ask yourself whether there are certain persons who are expecting, in vain, some material or moral help from you. It is very possible that progress in charity will enable you to recover the reassuring presence of God in your mental prayer, or at least the sense of not wasting your time at it. Christ cannot resist the prayers of those who, for their part, do not resist the appeals of their neighbors. As you well know, He considers whatever we do to others as being done to Himself. Saint Augustine, in his commentary on the first epistle of Saint John identifies Christ with his members by means of an unexpected and vigorous comparison, impossible to forget. He whom you adore in his head, you outrage in his body. He, for his part, loves his body. If you remove yourself from the body, the head does not cut itself off from its body. From heaven, the head cries out, "It is in vain that you honor me, it is in vain that you honor me." It is as if someone wanted to kiss your head by walking on your feet. His heavy hobnailed shoes would crush your feet while he was trying to grasp your head in his hands to kiss it. Would you not interrupt these demonstrations of respect with a scream and say, "What are you doing, wretched one, you are crushing me"? You would not say, "You are crushing my head," since he is honoring the head. But the head would speak louder for the members that are being crushed than for the honors it is receiving. The head would cry out, "I want none of your honors. Stop crushing me." If you answer, "How can you say that I am crushing you? On the contrary, I want to give you a kiss, I want to embrace you." But don't you see, foolish one, that, by virtue of the oneness that makes the body one single entity, what you want to embrace is present in what you are crushing. You honor me above, but you crush me below. There is greater suffering in what you are crushing than there is joy in what you are honoring, because what you honor suffers for the member you are crushing. I would be inclined to interpret this astonishing page in this way: you come to mental prayer to kiss my face, but you refuse your brother the honor and help he expects from you, and that I expect from you in him. Do not be surprised, therefore, that I react to you like a man who pulls away from someone who is stepping on his feet. I do not claim to have infallibly expressed Christ's sentiments toward you. I simply invite you to ask yourself a question. 26. The mental prayer of poverty. Shall I dare tell you that I am delighted over the sense of total impotence and failure you experience in your mental prayer? Believe me, it is not hardness of heart on my part, but the conviction that this harsh trial holds great benefits for you. You have abundant intellectual and material resources. You hold a position of authority. You are admired and feared, loved and obeyed. Many people and many things depend on you. And yet here is one area, the area of mental prayer, in which you are failing. You have made intense efforts to succeed, but to no avail. And you inform me in your letter that mental prayer is not for you, that you are giving it up. I beg of you, agree to think it over some more before giving it up. This daily time of prayer seems intolerable to you. Does the cause lie perhaps in your secret refusal to admit that you can be indigent, powerless, and poor, even for a half hour a day? If you have no sooner begun your mental prayer than you feel the urge to return to your professional activities, is it not because you are driven to prove to others and first of all to yourself that you are a capable man, creative and efficient? Be on your guard. I fear that you are yielding to an insidious, dangerous temptation that threatens to throw you into the company of those whom Christ condemned, the rich. A rich man is a somebody who can, who has, and who is. You need mental prayer so very much. In your current life, dominated by success, mental prayer offers you the opportunity to discover your limitations, to experience the truest, most beneficial poverty, poverty of soul. Bless it for enabling you to rediscover your childhood, the time when you could not do much of anything, didn't possess anything, and, tiny and weak, were dependent upon others for everything. In the kingdom of God, everyone is a child, defenseless, destitute, and poor. You ought to read more of the Bible to discover the beatitude of the poor, and meditate on it. I am not speaking only of the few lines in the Gospel known as the Beatitudes. The whole of the Bible is the Beatitude of the poor. From beginning to end, it sings their praises. But we need to understand what we mean by these words poverty and poor. Their definition is to be found not in the dictionary, but in the sacred texts.